You're tuning in to Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTOO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And yes, it is Earth Day. Very exciting. So, on that note, I have two short stories on Earth. And then we'll skip over to celebrating, well, it's Poetry Month, too. So, stay tuned, get settled. I'll be right back. You're listening to Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hello, I'm back. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And tonight's first story is by Diane L. Wood, titled Ancient Earth. You see, my little mermithums, this chart here shows the planet Sun as a ball of yellow flame. It's a copy from the planet charts taken from the archives in deep caves where humans hid from the elements in an effort to survive. It's dated 2055 AD. Strange how those humans had a need to put an age on everything by using numbers to date things. They actually numbered each year. A totally unnecessary exercise, as you should have learned by now. Our layers of growth retain all memories in a precise chronological manner and are available for recall at any given moment. Now, as you can see from our light spectrometer, this is how that same planet looks now. You can see the color has dulled to a subtle orange glow. Has everyone learned what color is? It's quite different to modern-day world where everything is white. Yes? Okay. If we were able to crack through the thick crust of ice above us, which covers the entire Earth, we'd be able to see that planet firsthand. Professor Groenover, yes, the Growth 1074, what is it? Why must we learn about planets and animals? It won't make any difference to our growth pattern. Indeed, it will, 1074. You see, what happened to this planet 500,000 years ago when the sun abruptly slowed its burning has a direct effect on how we live and how we must prepare for the future. Why, my dear young shoot, through studying ancient scriptures, we have discovered that life on Earth 500,000 years ago was very complex, and the tribes tried to kill each other. Matured marmosomes like myself can see that through the very nature of evolvement itself, that life forms will rise and become more and more intelligent than we are and also than it was before. Therefore, we have taken it upon ourselves to teach those seedlings all we can in the hopes that all species will interbreed and will, and while evolving, not regain the desire to kill. But, Professor, how can learning about the sun stop us from having a desire to kill? Which, I might add, being mermosomes, we don't have that desire in the first place. My dear 1074, as a youngster of less than 1,100 years, you are not able to comprehend the magnitude of the charismatic structure of evolvement. I am 10 times your senior, and already I have seen our species develop from a solely food-oriented seeker to a mostly food-oriented seeker with time for play. And what I've seen terrifies me. I'll tell you all, I have seen fresh young shoots purposely, gently slapping each other in the currents. I've seen it too, Professor. It was harmless play. That's how it begins. The method of eliminating such behavior in our growing world is to ply all of you with the knowledge you need to continue growth without such battering play. It must be stopped so it will not evolve into another world of tribal animals bypassing basic needs and killing each other. May I ask a question? Yes, Growth 1062, go ahead. How can you be sure that all the knowledge you give us will eliminate this behavior? Simple, 1062. We will not tell you about the wars that prevailed on the earth when animals lived on its surface. If nobody knows about it, then it will not be copied. You have just told us, Professor. Oh, dear. Yes, I have. Please, I'll swim this way to the opening of the chimney. Oh, dear me. Yes, in you go. Professor Gronover, there you are. I've been looking for you. Yes, Professor Grogray. Why have you been looking for me? How are your students going? Have you managed to erase all primal warring thoughts from them? No. Somehow I slipped up again and told them about the ancient earth dwellers. Had to send them all down the chimney of hot lava. Pity. In spite of their immaturity, their intelligence was promising. Well, keep trying, Gronover. We all have our slips. Okay, then. It's very hard to stick to the curriculum when they start asking questions. Are you sure we must start with the history of the sun? Seems to be the long way of explaining where we started and are heading. Yes, Gronover, it's all relevant and it does work. I've been using this method for 1,000 years now and have a 9% success rate. That's an improvement on my first 1,000 years of tutoring. I guess eventually I'll succeed. Very well, then. Where is my next group of students? Take the first current north and swim off at the coral outcrop. There's 50 young myrmecums waiting for you. Okay, I'll continue to try. Hello, my little myrmecums. I'm going to teach you about the sun. The planet was known as the hottest by the most intelligent and extinct animal on ancient Earth, the human. The end. That was Diane L. Wood's Ancient Earth, a short story. Hope you enjoyed that. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Ms. G, back with Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hope you liked that last story, The Ancient Earth by Diane L. Wood. believe it or not, someone emailed me that story. People always ask me where I get my stories. Oh, I get them from books. I get them from people who say, you should try this author. And they email me and they let me know what's going on. You can actually find my email address on the K2 website under local programs and Telling Tales with Ms. G. So there you go. Email me a story or an author you want me to check out for our show. Okay, so our next short story, again with the theme of it being Earth Day, is by Shaz Wellen, all one word. It's called The Nut That Fell to Earth. Bet you can't break mine no matter how hard you hit it, said Jod to his friend Bod. Bod stood back and with a mighty swing hit Jod's nut with a tremendous thwack. The nut, far from smashing, parted company from the cord which secured it and sailed in a long arc, up and away into the sky. Crumbs, exclaimed Jod. That was some hit. Their identical moon faces watched in awe as the nut disappeared into the pink sky. Now, it was really a matter of fortune that the nut path should intersect with a space loop that occurred every 2.3 million years, give or take a day or two. As the boys watched, the nut faltered in its orbit, wobbled, shook, then shot straight up in the air, disappearing in a crackle of electricity and sparks. The nut materialized a few billion miles away on a bright spring day on the planet Earth. It landed in the middle of a boggy field about 7 miles north of the M25 where it meets the M1. If you look close enough, you can see the nut falling to Earth. Can you see it? Can you see it? Now this nut, not knowing the difference between a field in Hertfordshire and one rather like it on the planet Zom, did what any self-respecting nut would do in similar circumstances. It made the best of things. Stuck a root into the soil and awaited its fate. Now, Zom is not a particularly fertile planet. Its soil, although able to sustain an abundance of plant life, is only about a third as rich as the soil 7 miles from the M25-M1 junction in Hertfordshire. Because of this, a great many plants from that planet are able to transport themselves from one patch of ground to another, always in search of ground with higher nutritional properties. Ben Cartland, who had worked the farm all his life, and as he was now 75, this had been a fair old time. He had watched farming change from horse-drawn plows right through to chemical fertilizers and aerial crop spraying. He thought that the farming business had very few surprises left. You can imagine, therefore, how he felt when he saw a bush growing in the middle of his cornfield, the size of which should have taken 10 years to grow. His weather-beaten face took on a quizzical expression as he approached the new addition to his farm. But this was nothing compared to his look when the bush moved away from him at the same speed to his approach. Ben stopped. So did the bush. He took two steps nearer. The bush moved two steps further away. Ben vowed to throw away the half-full whiskey bottle that stood on his kitchen table when he returned to the farmhouse. Ben's lean but still supple frame crept towards the bush. The bush continued its retreat. He tried to outflank it, but it only moved to one side. So this went on, man and bush zigzagging across the cornfield until they came to the stout wooden fence posts in the corner. Now Ben had a passion for goat's milk, which accounted for the fact that he was carrying a length of rope about his person that morning. Gertrude had once again bitten her way almost through her tether, and Ben had determined to replace it. He tied one end of the rope into a lasso and flung this over the cornered bush. The other end he firmly secured to the wooden post. Then it was discovered that the nuts were good to eat. The bush found the corner of the field very much to its liking and settled down happily, even if the rope did restrict its movement somewhat. Meanwhile, Ben, far from throwing away the whiskey, disposed of it in its usual fashion, which explained why the farm was left neglected for the remainder of the day. The next morning, the bush had grown into a small tree. This did not really matter, as it blended rather well with the other trees that grew along the edge of the field. The only trouble was a slight difference in color of the leaves. It didn't notice too much because they were a similar color as the May tree's blossom, but when the blossom fell, there would be something of a contrast. As the days passed, Ben got quite fond of his strange tree. Indeed, he even boasted to his friends that he had cultivated it himself. The only trouble was its phenomenal rate of growth. Already it was taller than even the most mature May trees. Late June saw the tree towering above the field like a giant sentinel, its pink leaves blocking out the sunshine from its surrounding area. It now rivaled the electricity pylons for sheer size. A trickle of people started to visit Ben's farm. First botanists from Kew Gardens, the scientists from Cambridge, and the men in dark suits from the Ministry of Ag and Fish. It had to happen, of course. It was really only a matter of time before the newsmen found the farm. TV cameras. Very serious reporters gave on-the-spot reports, and as the pictures hit the nation's screen, so hordes of sightseers appeared at the gates of the farm. Police were sent to control the crowds, and the M25 closed due to congestion. Eventually, the government declared the tree a national monument and sent in the army to protect it. Poor old Ben. He gave up trying to run the farm as a farm. Of course, the compensation paid by the government came in handy, but he felt it a loose end, with no real purpose left in his life. The summer wore on, and the tree continued to grow, changing position from time to time as it sucked the goodness from the ground. In August, tiny pink buds appeared all over the branches, and by early September, these had grown into round, mature nuts, which dropped in profusion all over the field and into the little lane running beside. In vain, the army and police tried to gather them up, but as soon as any nut dropped near the crowds of sightseers, they disappeared into pockets and handbags, reappearing in gardens, allotments, and greenhouses all over the country. It became illegal to grow the nut, so making it a truly forbidden fruit. This, of course, only made people keener to grow them. Ben, meantime, slowly drowned in the sea of whiskey, watching his tree develop through a misty haze. All through the following autumn and winter, in hundreds of gardens, the nuts lay in lovingly tended soil, each one waiting to thrust new shoots into the spring sunshine. The next summer saw pink-leafed trees scattered in every part of England. They moved faster than their parent as they adapted very quickly to the more favorable environment. This year, the growth was truly phenomenal, and most of the nuts had grown to 20 feet by May. These trees grew nuts all the time, and they matured and dropped every few days, leaving new seedlings in every corner. They grew like weeds, but your normal weed doesn't usually run away and hide. From the air, the once green landscape slowly turned to pink. Then it was discovered that the nuts were good to eat. Nutritionists found that the nut kernel contained every vitamin, protein, fat, and carbohydrate that it needed to sustain life. Food factories turned it into burgers, soups, stews, and sausages. It could be made to taste like anything that takes your fancy, meat, fish, poultry, or vegetable. Once liquidized, it made the perfect baby food. Everybody had the same beautiful thoughts and feelings. Here was the answer to the world's food problems. No longer would anyone need to go hungry. No longer would countries need to go to war over food supplies. Every government wanted this precious nut with their succulent, tender, pink flesh. Viewed from space, the land of masses slowly started to turn from green to pink. The pinkness spread across Europe and into Africa. The American continent sprouted pink spots as though it had caught a chicken pox. As people ate more and more of the nuts, so the strange things started to happen to them. They began to turn bright pink, first the skin, the hair, and finally the eyes. When everyone had become a uniform pink, then they began to look the same. Those people who were bald grew new pink hair. Those people who were fat became slim. Those who were thin grew sleek. Those who were short grew taller, and the tall grew shorter. Features changed, too. First, it was noses. People who all their lives had had to suffer with long, ugly conks woke up one day to find they had little turned-up noses. Then, it was other features. Mouths grew warm and soft. Ears were all perfectly shaped, not too large and not too small. One day, everybody looked absolutely identical. The same pink, perfectly proportioned bodies. The same handsome male and beautiful female faces. And then everybody had the same beautiful thoughts and feelings. Never again would one man raise his hand to another. Never again would one person think evil of another. The emotions of envy, jealousy, pride, and avarice all evaporated away. All this thanks to a little brown nut that had come sailing out of space from a planet far, far away. Epilogue. So you see why we cannot allow you a license to import the uniformity nut? Said the wise old chairman of the Galactic Council to that delegation from Venus. The same fate that overtook Earth could happen to you. Now it is a dead planet. Only the giant ink trees remain. The human race simply died of boredom, for they all thought the same things and did the same things with never a new idea or a new face, for they were all mirrors of themselves. The delegation from Venus turned sadly away in nodding agreement with the wise chairman. You just heard me read The Nut That Fell to Earth by Shaz Wellen. I hope you enjoyed that story, and I'll be right back with more from Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hello there, this is Ms. G, back with Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau. Hope you enjoyed that last story by Shaz Welling, The Nut That Fell to Earth. That was a good one. So, this is also Poetry Month. Yay! And I have definitely enjoyed this. Last week I had some poets on my show. They just did a big fundraiser at the Rookery and I got to attend and it was fantastic. And I'll play you one of the poems from that night. But first I wanted to pay some homage to Mr. Octavio Paz. He passed away April 19th of this year. Octavio Paz Elizondo was a Mexican poet and diplomat and writer. For his body of work, he was awarded the 1981 Miguel de Cervantes Prize, the 1982 Neustadt International Prize for Literature, and the 1990 Nobel Prize in Literature. This is his poem called Proem, spelled P-R-O-E-M. Is translated by Elliot Weinberger. At times, poetry is the vertigo of bodies and the vertigo of speech and the vertigo of death. The walk with eyes closed along the edge of the cliff and the verbena in submarine gardens. The laughter that sets on fire the rules and the holy commandments. The descendant of parachuting words onto the sands of the page. The despair that boards a paper boat and crosses for 40 nights and 40 days, the night sorrow sea and the day sorrow desert. The idolatry of the self and the desecration of the self and the dissipation of the self. The beheading of epitaphs, the burial of mirrors, the recollection of pronouns freshly cut in the garden of Epicurus and the garden of Nesuwakati, the flute solo on the terrace of memory and the dance of flames in the cave of thought, the migrations of millions of verbs, wings and claws, seeds and hands, the nouns, bony and full of roots, planted on the waves of language, the love unseen and the love unheard and the love unsaid, the love in love. That was Proem by Octavio Paz, the late Mr. Paz. Hope you enjoyed that. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I'll be right back with another poem. So this next poem is actually by one of our own, Christy Name Erickson. She's a wonderful poetess here in town, and this is a recording of off of her latest spoken word CD. And it's titled, How to Tell If a Korean Woman Loves You. That's the name of the CD. The name of the poem is You Bring Out the Korean Adoptee in Me. So let's get to that right now.
You bring out the Korean adoptee in me, the snowdrift eyelids, the unripe peach arms, the knee-jerk kisses I take and say for rainy days. You know, you bring out the red button heart in me, the flashcard Korean nouns in me, the message in a bottle, but the bottle broke, the fancy chopsticks. The 5-year-old Asian bob with perfectly curled bangs in me. All my pink dresses, every laced hem, every inch of frill, every warm white tight in me. You bring out the tacky bling in my iris. You bring out the frozen stir-fry vegetables and soy sauce in me. The 4-inch, no, 2-inch heels so I still look good and you still look tall in me. The 4th Killian and sloppy secrets in me. The dance, dance revolution in me. You bring out the airplane in me. The flame start turbine jet stream flight in me. The Pacific in tablespoons in me. The quake of migration, the tsunami of children. Our mother's treasure chest memories sunk into the bottom of their throats. The family tree with ghost branches. The hum of trains pumping below the pavement skin. The hum of one woman singing Adi Yang into the dusk room of 21 babies not her own, lives paused on lullabies. I want to sing this song for you. Roll my Korean adoptee tongue into quarter notes on your lips. I want to make you failed Asian recipes and steamed rice out of my 20-pound bag I will never finish. I want to tie donated hanboks loose on our long-lost bodies. Take photos of how Korean we are some days. The Korean adoptee in me, I'm always looking for someone to save me. You, broken history you, bulgogi smile you, half cigarette and sunglasses on the flat roof of a Seoul building, you, come here. Let me un-Levi, un-American eagle you. Let me play your fingertips like a grand piano and spread our palms out like last flimsy pieces of a 200,000 piece puzzle. And you can have mine. Breasts upon my chest, your midnight hair in my full moon hands. And not the language we lost or the language we were given has a word for this. This tear-streaked love. This yin-yang heartbeat beneath your cheek.
I hope you enjoyed that. That was You Bring Out the Korean Adoptee in Me by Miss Christy Name Erickson off of her CD, How to Tell If a Korean Woman Loves You. And she is a poetess of Woosh Kanadi. So this has been Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I certainly hope you enjoyed the show tonight here at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Until next time, good night.